From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. There's news on impeachment out of Washington, even though lawmakers have left for the holidays. Late last night, in a legal filing, the Department of Justice argued that a federal appeals court should stay out of a legal battle between the White House and Democrats over whether former White House counsel Don McGahn should testify in the impeachment process about obstruction of justice, because there is an impeachment process going on. But Democrats are renewing their calls for witnesses in a Senate impeachment trial after emails from White House budget official revealed over the weekend that he asked for a hold on U.S. military aid to Ukraine about 90 minutes after President Trump's July 25th phone call pressuring the Ukrainian president to investigate Joe Biden. And the official said in an email, "Keep this closely held." Tamara Keith is NPR White House correspondent. Hi, Tam.
Hey, how's it going?
Well, you tell us, because let's start with the Justice Department legal filing from Attorney General William Barr, who's been very supportive of President Trump. So put aside the legal questions here. What are the political ramifications? You know, for weeks, Republicans have complained that impeachment should not move forward because Democrats should wait for the courts. Now we have this legal filing arguing that the courts can't get involved. It seems as if it's setting up a situation where there would be no impeachment.
The Justice Department, what they want is for McGahn's testimony not to be compelled. You know, what this comes down to is a fight between the White House and the Justice Department, siding with the White House, and the congressional branch of government, a sort of an Article One, Article Two battle about whether top White House aides should be compelled to testify in congressional oversight. Now, the McGahn case is not related to the impeachment. It's actually related to the Mueller report and their investigation into that. But it's close enough. And what the Justice Department is trying to say is, well, gosh, if you weighed in on that, it might affect the impeachment proceedings. This case is set to be heard by an appeals court on January 3rd, assuming that they don't agree with the Justice Department on this.
Yeah, it's just kind of such circular reasoning. You know, on the one hand,
there's a lot of circular reasoning around here.
Yeah. A demand, you know, that you go to the courts, and then the Justice Department saying you can't go to the courts on this. What about these emails about Ukraine aid? They came out late Friday because of a Freedom of Information Act request. They show that Michael Duffy, a political appointee in the budget office, wrote to a Pentagon official within hours, I think 90 minutes after President Trump's July 25th phone call, saying, keep it close, but aid to Ukraine is being held up, quote, given the sensitive nature of the request. Then weeks later, Duffy sends an email saying, oop, the aid is being resumed. And when the recipient to the email asks, oh, what happened? His response is redacted. Your thoughts on this?
Well, so the White House argues that this email was just a coincidence, that it was sent right after the president's phone call. In reality, what these emails that have been released indicate, they just sort of fill in the timeline. We know that funding was put on hold sometime based on public testimony. We know that aid was put on hold sometime in early July, that it was widely known that it was held by July 18th. Then the phone call happens on July 25th. And these emails are interspersed with that timeline and do, by all means, give a sense that people in the Office of Management and Budget, the White House Budget Office, and also in the Pentagon and State Department, were concerned about the legality of holding these congressionally appropriated funds.
Yeah. Where are we in the standoff over the trial, the impeachment trial in the Senate? The House again voting to impeach or charge President Trump. They haven't sent the charges to the Senate. Senate leader, the Republican Mitch McConnell, was pretty clear. He wants only one outcome of this trial and not guilty for President Trump. On Fox News on Sunday, host Chris Wallace pressed Mark Short, Vice President Pence's chief of staff, for a response to Pelosi's strategy of not sending these charges over.
You're quite confident that this position is untenable and she's going to move it along, and that Chuck Schumer and Mitch McConnell reach a deal on how it's going to proceed in the Senate.
So you think that she'll eventually give in?
She will yield. There's no way she can hold this position.
What do you think happens here, Tam?
I think that Mark Short's analysis is probably right. You know, it's a holiday break, so there's not a huge amount of urgency. The Senate is not in session anyway. There's a couple of weeks here for for Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, and Chuck Schumer, the Minority Leader, to hash this out, to come up with some kind of an agreement about the path forward. And then presumably Pelosi will send things over. It's just that these negotiations are at an impasse right now. And there's been sort of an exchange of interviews and tweets and letters and other things to sort of keep this in the news while there isn't a lot of other news going on.
Right. And we remember in past impeachments in modern history, you know, the trial, the person on defense cooperated in the trial. So this is different. Tamara Keith, NPR yes. White House correspondent, thank you as always.
You're welcome.
The murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi sparked international outrage when he was killed in 2018 at the Saudi consulate in Turkey. Today, a criminal court has sentenced five people to death in connection with the murder. Khashoggi, which lived in Virginia, was a prominent critic of the Saudi regime. He had gone to the consulate to pick up documents related to his upcoming marriage. Frank Gartner is a BBC security correspondent and joins us from London. And Frank, what do we know about the people who were sentenced to death?
Well, they haven't given out the names, at least not initially, but they were named by Agnès Callamard, who is the UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial killings. They're not going to mean anything to most of us, but there was one name definitely that jumps out, and that's somebody called Maha Muthrib, a kind of security overseer, almost like a bodyguard, who was often seen with the Crown Prince. And that has been enough to link the Crown Prince, in some people's minds, to this grisly killing. The verdict has already been condemned by quite a lot of people, particularly by the UN Special Rapporteur, who's called it a mockery of justice, really a false trial, because the masterminds, as she puts it, of this killing have walked free. The hitmen have been convicted, but not the masterminds who ordered it, in her view.
And those masterminds, meaning Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, possibly?
Some would say that. There is a suspicion, certainly Western intelligence agencies, that he at the very least knew about this operation to silence Jamal Khashoggi, if not actually order it. But specifically, there are two people. There's somebody called Saud al-Ghahtani, who is his media advisor. But that title doesn't do justice to the fact that he organized a vast trolling operation to intimidate any critic of the Crown Prince. And he was known to be in conversation with the hit team that went out just before the killing. The other is somebody called Ahmed al-Assiri, who is the deputy head of Saudi intelligence. He went on trial but has been acquitted, and he was alleged to have orchestrated the whole operation. So let's be clear on something here, Tanya. I mean, I lived in the Gulf for many years. I've worked in the Gulf, in Dubai and Bahrain. I spent a lot of time in Saudi Arabia. There is no such thing as a rogue operation in that part of the world. Nobody does anything without permission from above. And I think that's why Agnès Callamard, the UN rapporteur, is so upset about this, because she thinks that whoever ordered this has walked free.
So essentially, I mean, is there any way to really know if this is even a legitimate trial? As you mentioned, a lot of folks have been talking about the fairness and transparency of it all.
Well, Human Rights Watch have already said that it's not a fair trial, that it lacks all transparency, as do practically all trials in Saudi Arabia. They're always shrouded in secrecy. And of course, that begs the question, do the authorities have something to hide? Is this a case of just simply doing away with some rather dirty business here? The fact is that Saudi Arabia is a huge, rich and important country, and it's got a very important ally in the White House. There's no doubt in my mind that when this took place, the Saudi leadership, particularly what's called the Emiri Diwan, the royal court, the Crown Prince, they said, look, don't worry, we've got this. We've got top cover in the form of Donald Trump. He's our ally. We're fine. This will blow over. And to some extent, it has blown over. And that's the really galling thing about this, is that it's business as usual for a lot of people with Saudi Arabia, because it is such an important country. It's also an ally of the West against Iran's encroaching influence all across the Middle East. So there is a sense in Western capitals that, look, some dirty business has gone on here. It's pretty murky, but we're going to actually hold back on a lot of criticism, because we need Saudi Arabia, not just to buy our guns, our weapons, but also as a force for stability in the oil market and as a bulwark against Iranian advancement.
You've mentioned that this has been blown over, but what is next? Do you think we'll see an investigation of the Crown Prince?
There have already been calls by the UN Special Rapporteur, Agnès Callamard, to investigate the Crown Prince. That's gone nowhere. And I think there is a sort of judgment of realpolitik, of realism, in Western governments, particularly in Western intelligence agencies, that while they strongly suspect there was the hand of Saudi government, possibly the Crown Prince himself, in all of this, they're not going to publicly come out and say anything because they need Saudi Arabia as an ally. So they just are hoping that this is the last of it and nothing like this ever happens again. So if you look at the message, the communique that went out a few hours after the verdict by Britain's Foreign Office, it was pretty mealy-mouthed. It called upon Saudi Arabia to hold to account all of those responsible. Doesn't name them. It doesn't say this trial is insufficient, but the inference there is obvious that they don't think this is a full account.
That's the BBC security correspondent Frank Gardner in London. Frank, thanks as always.
Thank you.
Just bury me in the ocean with my ancestors that jumped from the ships, because they knew death was better than bondage.
That was a scene from Black Panther, one of the highest-grossing superhero movies of all time. The success of Black Panther was kind of a I told you so, because it was just one step forward in efforts to diversify Hollywood. This decade, we also saw Oscars So White, the Me Too movement, and a public call for gender parity and more leadership roles for women. To help us look at the significance of this past decade in Hollywood, we're joined by Pia Sinha-Roy, senior film editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Pia, you actually started covering Hollywood in films in 2011, so you've essentially covered this entire decade. When did this conversation about diversity and inclusion really start to take off in this decade?
I think, yes, it's been funny to actually look back now at the beginning of the decade and at the beginning of my career and realize that, you know, conversations around race were not really being had. The very few times I even brought it up would be for films that particularly dealt with it, the topic. But even outside of that, those conversations weren't being had at all. And it was almost taboo to bring it up. But I think when 12 Years a Slave came around and it brought a spotlight into some groundbreaking wins at the Oscars, and then right after that we had two consecutive years of 20 all-white acting nominees at the Oscars.
It
resulted in that Oscar
so white
hashtag.
That
was very powerful because it started to shift the focus and the conversation. You know, when that hashtag called for the boycott of the Oscars, that's a big move. That's a big call, and it forces the industry to sit up for a moment and take notice of the issue.
Are we seeing an outcome from the Oscar So White and some of those other pushes?
I think we are, which is a good sign. What happened was the Oscar So White led the Academy to come out with their own initiative to try and double their membership of minority members and women by 2020. So they are definitely looking to do that. And I think that was an important step, if only because it's had a knock-on effect across major studios, major networks, agencies. Everyone's taking a look internally to see how inclusive they really are amongst their ranks. The only way we're going to achieve any kind of parity for gender and race and all other areas of underrepresented communities is to have those members of those communities in key positions that are decision-making positions in this town. Change, I think, has been coming, and it's been good to see that call to action in 2016 kind of actually set a motion going.
And yet, as the awards season is just getting started, there's already been some critiques over the way films like The Farewell, which is more than 80% in Mandarin, doesn't qualify for best film in the Golden Globes. What do we make of this?
I find the discussion around language and how it plays into what is a foreign language film, what is an American film, really fascinating. I think the Farewell director, Lulu Wong, has been very clear that her story is an American story. It's just that America isn't all white and all English speaking. And I think her film shows that. It shows a woman who is American, a Chinese American woman who goes back to China to be with her ailing grandmother. And obviously, when she's with her family, she's speaking Mandarin. And when she's, you know, outside of that, she's speaking English, just like a lot of us, you know, people who are straddling two cultures do.
Are there rules around this?
So there are rules around this. For the Golden Globes, best drama and then the best musical comedy categories, which is kind of their best picture prize, but divided into those two genres, they don't permit any films with more than 50% of the dialogue in non-English language. Those films automatically go into the foreign language race. So The Farewell is in the Golden Globes foreign language race, as is Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, which is fully in Korean. And this happened as well last year with Roma. So we've had this discussion increase, I think, this year with the Oscars disqualifying Nigeria's official entry, a movie called Lionheart, which is in the English language because Nigeria's official language is English. And so it really stoked a conversation around, was that fair? This is a movie made by Nigerian filmmakers in Nigeria. So why could it not qualify in the international feature film category, which is now the new name for the Academy's foreign language category?
Has there been any answers for that?
There hasn't yet. The Academy is sticking to its rules that any film with, I believe, like the majority dialogue in a non-English language is foreign language. And so that does apply for many films. But then in the case of Lionheart, that's definitely created some problems because I believe only about 11 minutes of that film is in the non-English language. So therefore it didn't qualify.
Wow. I'm learning
crazy?
A lot on that. Yes, that is really, it's really interesting. And it sounds that these films are really going to push that that rule and that guideline because people are upset over it. Let's talk about something else that was really big this decade. And it really, a tipping point came just last year, the year before last, the Me Too movement. What has happened since the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein and the cases around Harvey Weinstein? Now that that has bubbled up to the surface and the public really understands what's happening, have there been any changes in Hollywood?
The result of the Me Too movement in Hollywood was then the Time's Up campaign, which about 300 prominent women and industry figures in Hollywood came together in January 2018 at the Golden Globes to announce a Time's Up campaign, and that they really, it was a fight towards gender parity, racial parity, parity for any underrepresented minority in Hollywood, for them to finally be acknowledged, be represented, and to start getting up into the areas of decision making in this town.
Yeah, and when it comes to leadership roles in Hollywood, we have been seeing over the last few years some great projects that have come from women directors and women producers. Is it just perception or reality? Are we really seeing more women in leadership roles in Hollywood?
I think we are starting to see a significant shift. We have more women in the top positions at studios and networks who are getting to green light projects finally, which is so important. I think we're seeing more people of color rising to the top as well. It's not enough, I will say that, but there's been some initiatives that have been put in place with alongside Time's Up. So there was the 4% challenge launched at Sundance in January, where Tessa Thompson challenged everyone to work with 4% women in the works that they're doing.
Yeah, I have to say, though, at the same time, it's a wonderful start. But I think for someone who's not in Hollywood to hear 4% challenge, that means that it was less than 4%.
So basically, the 4% number came from the fact that women had helmed just about 4% of the top films between 2007 and 2018. So that 4% number became a call to action, and it became a challenge to ask people, can you make a difference? And if each of you work with 4% women in your particular projects, how can that then affect a larger change. So, you know, Universal Pictures signed on to take this challenge. MGM voiced their support. So there was support for this. And, you know, given that this just happened, you know, I think we are seeing, I believe this year, Universal, which, you know, encompasses Focus Features and DreamWorks as well, has released 7 and announced 17 more female-driven projects, female-directed projects, which is up from 4 in 2018. Mm. So the change is happening.
Mm-hmm. What do you expect we'll see as we move into the next decade, into 2020? Mm-hmm. It really seems like this conversation around diversity and inclusion is just getting started.
I think so. I think this is just the very beginning of something shifting. You know, we still have an overwhelmingly male-dominated industry, and it's a white male-dominated industry. And I should go further and say it's a white straight male-dominated industry. Mm. So when you're looking at that, you realize that the content here is not necessarily reflecting the fabric of America today. And I think that's very important because people want to see themselves. They want to see their stories reflected. I still say to this day, I don't think I've seen my own story really reflected accurately. The audience is out there, you know. And I think one thing that's been really key over the last couple of years with, as you mentioned, Black Panther, Get Out, Crazy Rich Asians, these movies have shown studios and the people in charge that they make money. Yeah. And at the end of the day, if something makes money, you can't ignore it.
That's Pia Sinroy, senior film editor for The Hollywood Reporter. Thank you so much for taking the time and Happy New Year.
Thank you for having me and Happy New Year to you as well.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world. And when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news. Dennis Muilenburg, the once beloved CEO of Boeing, is stepping down today under pressure from the board, replaced by Chairman David Calhoun after several weeks of intense criticism from regulators over Boeing's response to 2 fatal crashes of the 737 MAX that killed 346 passengers in March of 2019, before that October 2018. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst, has been taking this in. And Seth, Muilenburg has been under scrutiny for his role in the 737 MAX crashes ever since the first one went down over the Java Sea last year. Recently, that pressure seemed to ratchet up. So what's your reaction to the news today?
Well, the news today was unsurprising. There was sort of this point recently where if you had to bet, you'd bet that it was more likely that the outcome would be like this than that he would stay for the long term. As recently, though, Robin, as maybe a couple weeks ago, I don't know that any of us thought that it would happen this quickly. And then there was another series of events that just seemed to speed up the pace.
Well, we spoke to parents of victims who were furious about the push from Boeing to get the plane back in the air. Last week, the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, Stephen Dixon, reportedly rebuked Muilenburg in a private meeting for trying to rush the FAA to put the 737 MAX back in the air. Was that his undoing?
That was a big part of it, along with the suspension of production of the 737 MAXs. I think there was probably the idea that, you know, he wasn't going to be there forever, but that if the plane were to be able to be recertified and get back in the air quickly, that would be the moment when he could say, okay, my job here is done, and pass the torch to somebody else. But with that no longer imminent, and with all these questions like the ones you met, and then finally a couple of really critical articles in the national press over the weekend, the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, sort of confirming a lot of what had looked to be wrong along the way, all of that together ended up in this news today, which, as I said, by time it happened, not surprising.
Look, Muhlenberg started as an intern at Boeing in 1985, became CEO in 2015. In 4 years, tripled Boeing's share price when we said beloved, you know, certainly by, you know, stockholders. He was a golden boy. But when you look at this chapter, when people look back, some of this is so disturbing. Pilots weren't able to override a system that pointed the nose down. They weren't told how to do that when the company figured out what the problem was. I mean, how will Muhlenberg be viewed?
Yeah, you're right. You know, came up as an engineer. He was not a finance guy first. He was an engineer first. Ended up leading the space and defense side. Don't forget Boeing, you know, the commercial aircraft are only half of what it does. And then finally, the whole company. So you had those missteps that you mentioned in terms of the design of the plane, perhaps the communication, you know, clearly to some degree, the communication about what the plane could do. But then, you know, and I think really his undoing was how they reacted after the first and certainly after the second crash. Boeing never seemed to get out in front of things. You know, when that second crash happened on a Sunday, the grounding finally happened in the U.S. on a Wednesday with Boeing going along. But by Monday, it was clear to, I think, most of us that that's how it was going to end. So, but Boeing didn't get out there and say, you know what, let's take this step. And they never seemed to. They always seemed to kind of belatedly come along, kind of be listening more to the lawyers than maybe people with some other sense of where the world was going and get out in front of the news.
Seth Kaplan, here now's transportation analyst. Thanks as always.
Thanks, Robin.
Listen up, fall.
We've just arrived in Iceland. There's a storm. It's freezing. The rain is pelting down, the wind howling. But like thousands of tourists every year, we are wading into Iceland's iconic Blue Lagoon baths, man-made pools fed from the runoff water from the nearby geothermal plant, a tourist staple in Iceland. While the water is hot, the air is frigid. And then we go outside, half naked in the fog and wind, with complete strangers.
Hi. Where are you from?
Dallas, Texas.
Croatia.
We came to Iceland to report on climate change. We'll have all our stories at herenow.org. But what follows is a postcard from some of the people we just wanted you to meet. About 90 minutes northeast of the Blue Lagoon, we're standing by a quiet wading pool next to pretty wooden outdoor saunas and steam baths, strategically placed over natural springs.
There is no plumbing, no switch on or off or whatever. It's just a hot spring.
That's Siggy Hilmerson, managing director at Leuervatn Fontana on pristine Lake Leuervatn, his bakery dwarfed by an encircling range of mountains and volcanoes on the country's famed Ring of Fire, a volcanic hotbed which rises in places through tectonic cracks.
As you are going in here for a steam bath, you're just getting the energy directly from underneath. Power of the spring, it's often, you know, splashing, whoosh, whoosh. You are getting the steam, the heat, and everything. And the only way to control the temperature in these rooms is by opening up the doors and release the pressure inside.
And nearby, another volcanic tradition, lava bread. To bake it, we head to the gorgeous lake. We'll have pictures and videos at herenow.org.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, so now we're down at the banks of the lake.
Yeah.
Is this volcanic sand? Or?
Yeah, it is. And there are cracks in the rock bringing up boiling water, as you can see here.
And there's steam rising off of it.
Absolutely. So
Siggy's shovel hits a pot he buried in the black sand covered by boiling water.
When did you put this in?
24 hours ago.
Oh, wow. How hot is this water that we're looking at?
Boiling temperature. It's about 100 degrees Celsius.
It's about 220 Fahrenheit.
Right.
You put this pot with the bread and this boiling water under this volcanic sand.
Yeah.
Would people like your grandmother, like, you know, in the morning if they were going off to work in the farms, or would they just put the bread in and then when they come home? I'm hearing people still do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, when they felt like having a good bread, that this grandma put down bread here. Very often when they were expecting guests from Reykjavik, that they put down bread. So when they had, you know, coffee or whatever with these guests, they would pop up a nice warm rye bread from the hot spring. Okay. Looks perfect.
Oh, God. It's a loaf of bread in the pot.
Yeah. Smell the rye?
Yeah, yeah.
We leave a couple eggs to boil in the water and head back into the lodge where Siggy prepares the bread under the watchful eye of his elderly mother.
Think about it. We could be doing all of this.
A shovel has just been brought in with eggs.
Even, you know, if the electricity went out, you know.
Right here.
Okay, perfect.
Perfect yolk. Yolk and egg on top of trout and bread.
By the way, the other half of the lake is cold enough for those trout. The first piece of bread goes to Siggy's mom. Hmm.
Did you make bread like this?
Yes.
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 Absolutely.
Well, enjoy.
It's sweet, almost like rye gingerbread. Siggy says it's an important reminder of the past at a time when so much in the region is changing.
Well, we have less snow now than we used to have. What we also see today that we didn't see before is the growing of the trees. I mean, they are growing much faster than they used to, and we are getting, you know, new types, and climate change is obviously affecting the whole world. And they are estimating that in 200 years, all the glaciers are gone here in this country if the climate change keeps on developing like it is today.
And just, you know, I mean, we're eating the rye here and the other elements in this. We're hearing that farmers, especially farmers, you say, who might be right at the base of a volcano and they're getting the ash, we're reading about some of them who are changing from, let's say, cows and dairy to things like barley or grains that can be made into biofuels.
Farmers that have changed from the original farming. Climate change can definitely change farming in this country.
Just down the road from Leuervatn Fontana, some hungry cows at the Efstedaler farm, where we meet Halla Rose Arnesdotter. She runs the property with her siblings.
It has been in the same family since 1700 something, and now we are the fifth or the sixth generation.
And the first to confront the modern era, scrambling to take advantage of the new tourist boom with a small hotel and a beautiful farm-to-table restaurant right in a barn, and a concern about climate change.
I think about it every day, and we try all our best what we can do about it, and there are things we do. For example, we recycle everything on the farm, no matter what it is. We do compost, plastic, paper. The general waste is almost nothing.
It's harder to address the erratic weather, for instance, to make enough hay last year to feed the cows.
We had almost no sunshine the whole summer. It's hard to believe there was only one little gap which we could possibly cut the hay and dry it. And we were really concerned if we would have enough hay for all of our animals. And then last year, it was totally opposite. We had sunshine every day, and we were praying for rain. So we are talking about two crazy years, and no one remembers this.
Well, didn't Reykjavik just have its highest temperature on record?
Yeah.
Not every farmer has been able to adapt the way Halla and her siblings have.
Sadly, they're giving up. You know, they're like, this has been year after year after year, and being, for an example, a cow farmer, because the hay is so important, and when you are this and you're always just about surviving the winter, it's just too hard. That's what I hear.
Back down the road at Leuervatn Fontana, Siggy reflects on the changes in his island country. He appreciates the tourists who've given his bakery a new life, but he's also proud to share with them his family's lava bread.
So how long has your family been here?
Since forever, basically.
Since Vikings?
Since Vikings, yeah. My grandmother used to do this, and my mother, and a lot of the local people here do it. Yeah. Of course, you know, like anywhere else in the world, you know, life changes and things change, but this has always been the same, and so it brings up warm memories. I mean, yeah, definitely.
Christmas tree growers are reporting that 2019 has been the best year they've had in decades. Part of that is tight supply, but it also happens that millennials, who account for a quarter of the population here in the U.S., are really into Christmas trees. For more on that, we have with us Chal Landgren, a Christmas tree specialist at Oregon State University. Chal also grows Christmas trees on a 5-acre farm. Welcome to Here and Now.
Oh, happy to be here. Thank you.
Why has this year been such a good year for Christmas tree growers?
Well, it's been a good year partly because we've had a number of very bad years. So to give you an example, in Oregon at least is down to about 366 licensed Christmas tree growers. In 2006, we had almost 800 growers producing almost 7 million trees. And my guess this year is we're down to producing about 4.5 million trees with a lot fewer growers. So those, it's been a hard time for the growers that were kind of forced out of the business because of oversupply. But now that we're in a position of a tighter supply, prices are up and growers are very, very pleased with the way this year has been working out.
You mentioned that year, 2006, something I learned a few years ago when visiting some Christmas tree farms in Oregon is that it can take as many as 10 years for a Christmas tree to grow. So many of those trees we're seeing today were first planted 10 years ago, right after the Great Recession. Does that really factor into the supply we're seeing this year?
Yeah, it certainly does. You know, that kind of depression era, even though a lot of people still bought Christmas trees, is one that happened to coincide with overproduction years. And like a lot of ag products, Christmas trees are cyclical, and they're on the 7 to 9 year cycle. And supply right now is low, but prices are up, and growers are, the ones that are still growing trees out here are pleased.
What about climate change? We know in Oregon, where you are, the last few summers have been really hot and dry. On the other hand, there are Christmas tree farmers in Missouri who got their entire crop wiped out this year by floods.
Good question. You know, and in Oregon, 2019 was a good year to grow trees. And we're talking about seedlings now that were planted in 2019. We had a good survival. But 2015, 17, and 18, we had incredibly dry, hot summers. And growers, particularly, again, that were planting noble fir, lost, you know, some of them lost their entire crop in those years. And it was hard to get seedlings because people were trying to back up 2 or 3 years' worth of seedling loss. So we're going to see, I think, another dip in production here in about 6 years because of that loss of noble fir plantings.
Mm. I'm thinking about those who also work on those farms. I hear that you hire high school kids to work on your farm.
On our farm, which is just a tiny little blip in the industry, we hired high school kids during Thanksgiving break. But for most of the bigger farms and most of the farms throughout the U.S., we're using largely migrant Hispanic labor. And it's always been a problem to get labor, but that's getting tighter and tighter.
Mm. You know, a lot of us are more conscious about where our goods come from. Is there anything consumers can do to make sure they're getting their tree from a responsible farm?
I would just have the consumers look at what the farm looks like. The less you have to drive to a farm, the less you're going to have in terms of a carbon footprint to get your tree. So it's just an individual looking at where they're going, if they're going to a U-cut farm anyway.
Yeah. You know, I know you have a personal bias on this, but when it comes to being better for the environment, we often talk about real versus artificial trees. What's better for the environment? Should we have a fake one or a real one?
Well, I am biased, so yeah. I would say the real tree is going to be the better one for the environment. I mean, the artificial tree industry did a study where they looked at a narrow set of variables. And, you know, from their study, you know, if you kept the artificial tree for something like 5 to 8 years, there's less carbon with the artificial tree. But, you know, the real tree is totally recyclable. It also is a viable non-irrigated crop that sustains, you know, rural economies in areas where there's not a lot of economic activity. So my bias is towards the real tree.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time with us. That's Shao Landgren. He is a Christmas tree specialist at Oregon State University and a tree farmer himself. Thank you and happy holidays.
Oh, same to you. Thank you.
All right, Robin, are you a real person or a fake tree person?
Well, I'm a real person. But
I know, right? You're definitely real.
Right. When it comes to trees, I agree because I live in a town that recycles them. So you put them out and they chip them into mulch, which everybody they can use. And, you know, here, we're on the East Coast, you're on the West. Probably West Coast does this as well. They can be used for soil erosion barriers. Like they can put them along the beaches to help with erosion. So I'm on the real.
Yeah, I'm on the real, too. I grew up with fake ones, but I'm a real person.
Yeah, we're real.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
Hitting the post. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.